This is the Andy Pollin Hour. On Washington's new home for sports. ESPN 630, the sports capital.
You probably know the routine by now. Day starts with tea. We do two hours with Tony off today. He's back tomorrow, so we roll till noon. Max Kellerman, who is a Tuesday regular, will join me at 10:20, and we'll talk more about the wild weekend in the NFL and the clamor now to change the overtime rules. We'll get to all of that. Also, it was 48 years ago today that our hopes for getting baseball back here, only 2 years after the Senators left, were quashed by the chairman of McDonald's buying the San Diego Padres. We'll look back on that. And a whole lot more as we roll through the morning here. A couple of columns to point out to you after we kind of exhale after this wild football weekend. And I think we all had this feeling when we came out of this on Sunday night that this was incredible. But in reality, it feels kind of dirty because the NFL is... Yeah, it's icky. And a very good column today in the Post by Adam Kilgore. And I'll just read you his lead paragraph, which pretty much covers it all. He gets into what happened in the games. We did all that yesterday. He said, "The NFL so often punishes its followers for their devotion. Its owners have plundered cities for new stadiums and effectively blackballed a Super Bowl quarterback for protesting police violence," Colin Kaepernick. "The sport brutalizes its players. The league is withholding the details of an investigation into a culture of sexual harassment within the Washington franchise. It owns a shameful history of equitable hiring for black coaches. It dares you to love it." And at the end, he says you can't take your eyes off it. And it's so true. There's also a column from Kurt Streeter in the New York Times where he says that the NFL doesn't give a rip about diversifying its ranks. It doesn't give a rip what you or anyone else thinks about its pathetic hiring practices. And yet, even when not reporting, I watch the games grappling with internal conflict all along. I'm hardly a rabid fan, but the game helped me bond with my father as we watched the 1980s and 1990s Seattle Seahawks, and it now helps me connect with my 11-year-old son. My boy will never play football because his parents know the risks of brain damage, and he does too, but the NFL is sucking him in. He loves Patrick Mahomes, partly because they share a mixed-race heritage. He hangs on to Pete Carroll's every move. To him, Russell Wilson is always Danger Russ, and Aaron Rodgers is always Rodgers right. And it's so true. And when we have a weekend like this, you know, we tend to forget all the chattering about, oh, wow, if the details ever come out about the investigation into the Washington football team, the league is really going to take a hit. Yeah, briefly, it would. But the NFL says, no. Look over there. We just had four games that were walk-offs. They were four incredible games. And after three of them, when you thought, there's no way the fourth one can be as good, it was better. And so that's what we have here. We have a conundrum. On one hand, we look at the league and we say, God, it's disgusting what goes on with these billionaire owners and the amount of money that they make and the way they're able to cover up the foibles of what they do. And on the other hand, we go, man, though, it's a great product and it's a great Sunday afternoon. And yeah, and as Kurt Streeter points out in the Times, it's great for family bonding. You know, my son and I really didn't watch Washington football games together while he was growing up because I was always doing the pre and the post game show and I wasn't home. And he never really became a big fan, partly because they were terrible. And that has a lot to do with the shrinking TV ratings for the team, that they've lost essentially two generations with their play over the last 30 years. But I do know that football is a bonding agent for fathers and sons in the way that baseball used to be, and maybe still is to some extent. But especially with texting, where you can be in different cities and be watching the same thing and having a conversation while the game goes on and off about, you know, what happens in the game and everything. I mean, it's just different. And I feel like, you know, I have my Twitter followers, and when I sit down to watch a game, we have conversations about what's going on. I throw things out. Sometimes I get killed. Sometimes people agree with me. But it's a real communal experience. And when you have four games like we had on Saturday and Sunday, you know, you just can't find much wrong with the product. Now, behind the scenes, yeah, it's icky, but it's like sausage. You know what they say? They say if you like sausage, you don't want to go to the sausage factory to see how it's made. Now, you get sort of a glimpse of what goes on in the sausage factory from the various things that come out, but you didn't see the whole Beth Wilkinson report, so you don't know how icky it was in the organization. You have a pretty good idea and very good reporting by the Washington Post as to what was going on. But, you know, that you don't feel that when you're in the middle of the games on Sunday and a game that's gone down to the wire and a game that was decided in overtime, which leads us to what is, I think, the number one topic in sports today. At least it was yesterday, and I think it bleeds over into today as well. It's kind of like a second-day story. Yesterday, you're talking about the way the games played out and how exciting they were. Now you're talking about, well, did the Buffalo Bills get screwed because of the way the overtime rules worked, that they did not get to touch the ball in overtime? Now, I'm from the school of thought of, no, defense is part of the game. You're supposed to try and stop the other team. The first overtime game in the history of football, because they used to have ties in college, and the first one that they had was in 1958, what was called the greatest game ever played between the Baltimore Colts and the New York Giants, and what really attracted a lot of people to professional football because they were able to see the ending on national TV. You got to remember this. The Giants won the flip. They elected to receive and didn't get a first down, and they punted to the Baltimore Colts. You know, years and years have gone by, and all we talk about is how Johnny Unitas led the team down the field and gave it to Alan Ameche for the winning touchdown. But the defense had done its job against the New York Giants, and they had stopped them. And so the team that won the greatest game ever played, or as it was called, wasn't, but as it was called, was able to also play defense as well as offense, with the great Johnny Unitas taking the team down the field in the swirling winds of Yankee Stadium and the freezing cold, and the rest is history. But that seems to have been forgotten now, and we focus on, oh, it's just not fair. Now, ironically, the first time that this really reared up in this way, I guess it did before, but the Kansas City Chiefs were on the short end of this. And this was 4 years ago when they lost the flip in the AFC Championship game against the New England Patriots. And Tom Brady took the Patriots down the field and scored the winning touchdown. And Kansas City never touched the ball. And they did not get an opportunity to extend the overtime, and they were out, and New England went on and beat the Rams in the Super Bowl. And maybe that, you know, that Kansas City team was capable of doing. In fact, I'm sure they probably were, because they won the Super Bowl the next year. This was Albert Breer yesterday on the Dan Patrick Show, and he referenced what Kansas City proposed in 2019, changing the overtime rules so each team could touch the ball, and where we are with this right now.
So the Chiefs brought this up and brought this to the table, that each team should have at least one possession. And then if it's tied after one possession, go sudden death after that. And a lot of people looked at that as sour grapes because it came right on the heels of the same thing happening to Kansas City in the AFC Championship game. And you remember the scenario was almost identical, right? Like, if you remember that game, what happened in that game was it was a heavyweight bout between two great quarterbacks. And in the end, the defenses were completely out of gas. I mean, you remember that, Dan, like Dee Ford was offsides because it was just, you felt like the defenses had given everything they could and they were completely out of gas. And I think it was the same thing here. If Buffalo gets the ball, Kansas City's defense is out of gas, and it happens to the Chiefs again, you know? And so I see both sides of this, and I think it's a difficult one because on one end, the competition committee and the league have been trying to limit the amount of damage that goes on to football players' bodies. And that's why they went from 15-minute overtime to 10-minute overtime. So they don't want to have 20, 25, 30-minute overtimes in the playoffs. They just, because of the player safety, health and safety stuff, you've got that. I also understand where people are saying, well, it's not like one of these things where you just need 30 yards anymore, right? Like you need to go 75 yards in most cases to score. So if you can't stop them, you deserve to lose. I understand all that. I also sort of understand where the rules now are so tilted towards the offense, and we're seeing these just worn out defenses in these situations where it does feel a little bit like it's a fait accompli when Kansas City wins the toss that they're going to go right down the field. And I believe they only faced one third down going down the field, right? Which is very much like the ease with which the Patriots went down the field on the Chiefs 3 years ago.
Yeah, so I see this particularly from the standpoint of worn out defenses. I feel like, you know, if Buffalo gets the ball, they're going to score a touchdown too. And this may go back and forth for hours like this. Well, I'm being facetious, but it's going to go for a long time. And so on one hand, you're balancing the, oh, we got to be safe now. We can't have the players out there all day. And when do you have injuries in sports? You have injuries when people are tired. That's when they happen. And so you're more likely to have more injuries. And, you know, let's say you have a playoff game like this and it goes on for while it goes on, you know, maybe almost a full quarter, 15 minutes, and the starting quarterback gets knocked out, can't play the rest of the way. You know, Patrick Mahomes tears an ACL, God forbid, and so the Chiefs have to move on. I don't even know who the backup quarterback is. I mean, that's where they are at. So, you know, they shortened the overtime during the regular season from 15 minutes to 10 minutes because they were concerned about injury. So I'm with – now I'm old too, but I'm with the old guys, Tony Kornheiser and Mike Wilbon, talking about this proposal yesterday on PTI.
Tony, I would not be offended. I would not be outraged if the NFL not only considered changing the rule but changed it. But I don't see that as necessary. I think that defense ought to be required in any NFL game, particularly playoff games. So I'm not looking around saying, oh, my God, this team was wronged because they lost, in this case, Buffalo, on Kansas City going down the field and scoring. Then play some defense and get them off the field to give your team a chance. There ought to be incentive in that direction. That's the way I'm feeling about it. But I won't make a stink if they do change the rule.
I'm exactly in your position. Exactly. You want to change the rule, change the rule. You don't like this rule, go ahead and change the rule. Just don't tell me that this rule is unfair.
Right.
Football is a sport equally divided among defensive players and offensive players. It's not 9-1 like in baseball. It's 11 here and 11 there. You want the ball back? Play some defense. Don't yield a touchdown. You don't yield a touchdown all that often in a regular game, in the first 60 minutes of the game. Don't yield a touchdown here. Don't tell me that it's an automatic that if you win the coin toss, you win the game. Go out and play defense. That's half your job.
Yeah, but you know what? The NFL has tried to legislate out, defense out of the game for the past 25, 30 years. So, you know, this is what they got to deal with.
Not only that, one other element to add into the conversation, someone who has played professional football, has worked in the front office of a team, worked here for Washington, and now is a broadcaster for ESPN, Lewis Riddick, with another thought on where we are with stopping the other team.
What I came away from that game thinking was this, more so than anything. Defensive football in the NFL is awful.
The worst.
It is flat out awful. It is flat out awful in many respects, because I'll tell you what, there's a reason why Tom Brady is playing, or why he wants to keep playing, or why he continues to keep playing. And I'm not saying it isn't because Tom hasn't played great football his entire career, because he has. But he started off his career playing at a time when defenses actually challenged people. And I know people are going to say, well, they legislated physicality out of the game, and you can't do this. BS. Okay, there's some things that they've taken away from defenses, but there's still enough tools for you to be able to play better defense than what you saw in critical moments yesterday in that game.
Yeah, so the emphasis clearly has been on offense in the NFL, and they tweak the rules from time to time to change things. You know, it used to be that defensive backs would be able to mug wide receivers, and in 1978 they changed that, and the passing numbers changed dramatically. Something else, too. I think you see this at the youth level. The best players go play offense. And, you know, something Lovie Smith said years ago when he was coaching the Bears, he said he didn't mind his quarterback, Rex Grossman, who, by the way, was an interception machine but would take all kinds of chances. And he said he didn't mind it so much. He said, because defensive backs can't catch. That's why they're defensive backs. They all wanted to be wide receivers, but when they couldn't catch, they moved them to defensive back. And so we have a drop-off, I think, a little bit. Not that there aren't some incredible defensive players with incredible ability, but overall, I think the better players are on offense. A larger percentage of them play on offense. So that's something there. Now, among these proposals is the one that Kansas City brought up 3 years ago, where each team would have possession and that you'd play at sudden death after that if the second team scored a touchdown. So you would have an opportunity to go down and kick a field goal. There's that. Also, there's the XFL rule. Now, the funny one that I was thinking of, and this is not this iteration of the XFL from 2 years ago, it's the original one from, I believe, 2000 or 2001, where instead of a coin flip, they would throw the football down the field and one player from each team would race down and try to recover it. So that sort of evens things out, right? If you have a guy who's really fast and can get down the field and recover it, that's sort of a competition there. The problem is they started to have some injuries with that, and it didn't quite work out, so they went back to the coin flip. So there's that. There's also the one that we just had a couple of years ago. We had a team here, as a matter of fact, they did this. It consists of five rounds in which they're alternating single-play possessions like an NHL shootout or a soccer penalty kick. Each possession started from the opponent's five-yard line, and the team with more points after five rounds was declared the winner. Interesting. This one seems to be getting traction. I don't like it, but it seems like people are talking more and more about this. Spot and choose. Baltimore Ravens suggested this last year. They suggested that the format works as follows. The team that wins the toss gets to choose where to spot the ball. Anywhere on the field, their own 10-yard line, or the other team chooses where to start on offense and defense. So what you do is you say, okay, we're going to start the ball at the 40-yard line. And the other team says, okay, we're going to play defense from there. Or we're going to play offense from there. So in this scenario, teams would have to be much more strategic rather than hoping for a coin toss. According to NFL research, the teams that won the overtime coin toss are 86, 67, and 10 under the current format. That's 53% of the time. But, and here's the one that's really making people crazy. During the playoffs, the team that wins the toss is 10-1. So there's that. And that I think that addresses with what was talked about by Albert Breer is that the defenses are so gassed, they've got nothing left. The playoffs are a little bit different than the regular season. But I'm with Josh Allen, who was on the short end of this, and he said, the rules are what they are. I can't complain about that, because if it was the other way around, we'd be celebrating too. And ask Patrick Mahomes about that. He's been on the short end of this and on the winning end of this, as he was on Sunday. So we'll see. We'll get into much more with this with Max Kellerman, who joins us next. Stay with us. It's the Andy Pollin Hour, ESPN 630. You hear Max Kellerman every morning here on ESPN 630, along with Keyshawn Johnson and Jay Williams, and he has a television show every afternoon on ESPN called This Just In, and he joins us now, and I want to get to, obviously, the big debate that you guys have been having and everybody else has been having about overtime, but you spent, what, 4 years working in L.A.? Did I hear that right?
Six years.
6 years, okay, and you did sports radio there, so you have a real feel for this. You know about Andrew Whitworth, the tackle for the Rams. His wife is saying she'll buy any tickets that any Rams fans want to sell to 49er fans. Matt Stafford's wife had a podcast where she said something about this. And even Sean McVay weighed in on this yesterday. What's your feel about this, that a team from the North, a division rival, has sort of taken over one of the brand-new stadiums in the NFL?
That's what happens. I mean, there are stadiums like that. The Dallas Cowboys experienced that, right? That's part of the fan kind of impact on teams. In the NFL, it's real. You know, you don't want to go to play at – you don't want to play on the road anyway, but you don't want to play at Arrowhead or a place like that that gets stupid loud. And this is part of the way fans kind of have an impact on the actual outcome of the game. I love it.
Yeah, well, I mean, you worked there right before they got the Rams and before the Chargers moved there. Do I have that right?
Exactly, yes.
Yeah, okay.
While I was there, it was underway already, Kroenke and everybody, and right, they got the team basically right when I left.
Okay. What I know from people who are friends who live there, what they used to tell me is, we don't want a team because in those days they had blackouts. But they liked the idea that they could watch other teams play football. And they said, you know, L.A., it's a Lakers market. It's a Dodgers market. People go to the beach on Sunday. They don't really want the NFL. And the NFL moved two teams there. So, you know, where is the league? I guess the market size has a lot to do with it, and the NFL is based on television. I understand that. But it seems like the city doesn't really want it.
Well, first, you know, I lived in D.C., or at least had an apartment in D.C. for 15 months in like 02, 03, right? Because I was the original host of Around the Horn
right.
on ESPN. And I can tell you, like, when Gibbs got hired again, that's all, like, it's not one of those towns. It's not, like, D.C. is a crazy football town, and that's not L.A.
Yeah.
However, people were excited in L.A. about getting a team. The number one team in L.A. by far is the Lakers. Everything put together is not the Lakers. Number two is the Dodgers. And number three is actually SC football, if they're good, or the Raiders. The Raiders have the hearts of L.A. in terms of NFL football. But I like the idea of the Rams because they were the original L.A. NFL franchise. You know, they actually did real business in L.A. in terms of on-the-field success. And so they were the heritage team, really. And they came back, and they came back strong. You know, right away they were good. In fact, you bring up Whitworth. It was really the signing of Whitworth that made McVay's offense work to me more than anything else. You know, like when Whitworth came on board, that whole thing worked offensively. And when he hasn't been good because he's been hurt or he's been out, different. It's just different. So, no, I like the idea that they got teams. Now look. The people I know and worked with and hung out with, a lot of them are in the business that you and I are in. So, of course, we were all very excited to have an NFL football team there. It was good for business. But my sense was L.A. was pretty excited about getting the NFL back.
Okay. But do you think that that city or that stadium can ever replicate the atmosphere that we saw in the Four this weekend?
No. Well, could it ever? Yes. Here's the thing about L.A. Like, okay, so I grew up in New York. I live in New York now. New York radio, right? If your team is no good, it's not like people don't pay attention. They call radio shows and they're angry. Like, the media focus is still intense. It's just negative. In L.A., if you're no good, they forget you.
Yeah.
They forget about you. Because, as you said, they'll go to the beach. The weather's nice. So it's a different kind of pressure. Like, the pressure in L.A. is just to stay relevant. The pressure in a place like New York or Philly, you know, you got to be good. It's a different kind of place. I can even tell you, living in L.A. those 6 years, the feeling is you've quit the rat race. Like, everyone back east is still in the rat race, and you've quit it. And you've gone to, what was the Albert Brooks movie, Defending Your Life?
Oh, yeah, that was great.
To that kind of heaven. It's not perfect, but it's pleasant. You know, it's always pleasant. That, you know, at least living at a certain level in LA. I don't want to make it sound like, you know, LA doesn't have problems.
Yeah.
But and so given that context, you don't find the same kind of passion for NFL football that you'll find in Wisconsin, in Michigan, you know, in Pennsylvania, or, you know, a place like that where a cold weather place, deep roots and ties to the NFL, and a kind of attitude towards sports in the NFL that lends itself to kind of commercial success. LA's a little different.
Okay. The crazy thing is, if the Rams win, they will have the true home field Super Bowl advantage that Tampa didn't really have last year because of the restrictions of COVID. I think they only had 25,000. So if there is an L.A. Super Bowl with the Rams in it, do you think that the Ram fans will be anxious to buy up tickets, which, you know, God knows what they charge now, five grand a ticket or something like that? Do you think that it will really be a home field advantage for them if that's the case?
I don't know. I'm curious about that. I suspect they'll have a home field advantage.
Yeah.
But as I said, it will be nothing like if the Chiefs were playing at Arrowhead, right, in the Super Bowl somehow. You'd suspect they'd have it. But look, the Rams need time to build the kind of loyalty, say, that the Lakers have in L.A. You know, the Lakers, I try to explain this to Knicks fans. Well, the Lakers are no good, and you still like the Lakers. Why do you turn your back on the Knicks? The Lakers have built equity in with the fan base over decades of competing and winning and championships and the whole thing. And so even if the Lakers aren't good for a while, the town still cares. The Lakers have earned that. Have the Rams earned that from Los Angeles since they've returned? I think they've built something. It's not the Lakers, right? But they've built something. They've been to a Super Bowl. They're usually a good double-digit win team. They've advanced in the playoffs again, you know, and they're in the conference finals. They are – they're getting there. They're starting to build the kind of equity. So I suspect that it will be a home field advantage, but again, obviously nothing like the Chiefs would have if they were at Arrowhead.
Yeah, and it would also be probably snowing in 4 degrees, so that wouldn't be so great either. We're talking to Max Kellerman, who you hear every morning here on ESPN 630. Yeah, you've been debating it. I just played the comment that Lewis Riddick made to you guys, I believe it was yesterday, about how bad defense is. I'm on the side of, you know what? Defense is half of football. If you lose the coin flip, stop them and stop this whining about not getting the ability to touch the ball in overtime. What's your feel on this?
I've never liked the NFL overtime rules, not because of what you just said. I agree with you.
Mm-hmm.
But because a coin flip determines possession and therefore usually the outcome. So, for example, we just looked at this. The playoff record in overtime games in the last, whatever it was, 10 games. That's like 9-1.
10-1 now. 10-1 off.
10-1, right.
Yeah.
Who wins the coin flip? So I'd like to take the coin flip element out. Not that every chance or the same chance,
mm-hmm.
but the coin flip element out. And the way I would do that, and I propose this on this just in, 2 p.m. Eastern, ESPN, handsome host. Like, good show.
Absolutely.
But I proposed this yesterday. Why not just pick up the game where it left off as though you're going from the third quarter to the fourth quarter?
Ooh.
It would affect strategy and everything. And now, since you are out of time, you don't want to just put 10 minutes on the clock, although you could. Mike T brought that up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you put some time on the clock, so at least likely both teams get a chance. But I say sudden death. And so, you know what, you're kicking off to the Bills because you scored last. You know, and if they win, okay, fine, don't play catch-up. You know, it would what I like about it is it would affect strategy in an interesting way.
Yeah.
And it's logically consistent, at least from one point of view, with the idea is you're out of time now. Who's won? Well, it's a tie score. No one's won. Then keep playing.
Yeah.
For how long? Until someone scores.
The only thing I don't like about that is it takes away the strategy of trying to win the game before it gets to overtime. So if you know you have that cushion and you got the ball and you're going to need extra time once the clock runs out in the fourth quarter, you're not going to really try anything to try and win the game in regulation.
Well, except that if it's your ball, yeah.
Yeah.
But what if it's going to be their ball?
Yeah,
right?
Okay.
Depending on down and distance, right?
Yeah.
So the best argument against that proposal, I think, is, look, however the team caught up or didn't catch up at the end, the game is a tie score, right? And so it shouldn't just be that because the team played catch up that now they are at a severe disadvantage, right? Mm-hmm. The real problem is it's gotten so easy to score in the NFL that if you win the coin flip, you're going to win because you're going to score, right? That's the real issue. And so if you want to address that, I suppose you could put 5 minutes on the clock, 10 minutes on the clock, something like Mike Tannenbaum proposed. But I think it's asking a lot for players to – Tannenbaum's idea is that, look, it's not going to take all 10 minutes for someone to score, right?
Right.
But, still, you're playing 10 more – his proposal is it's only 3 or 4 minutes or whatever it is of actual playing. But it's a lot to ask players who just played a full NFL game that time of year. Hey, play 10 more minutes. And if it's tied, play another 5 minutes
or
whatever.
Well, also, as you know, when you are tired, you're more likely to get hurt.
Yeah.
So the longer you play, and, you know, God forbid, you're in the 12th minute and Patrick Mahomes tears his ACL. Oh, my God. You know, then the whole focus changes. So you've got that, too. And again, I'm with Lewis Riddick. You know, play some damn defense and don't do that.
I'm with it. I'm saying, like, that's fine with me. Just don't decide it on a coin flip.
Yeah, well, you know what else?
I'm playing football.
And you probably remember this, when the original XFL came out. Remember how they did away with the coin flip and how they would start the game? Do you remember this?
I don't offhand.
Okay, that what they did was they would, and I think they had a celebrity thrower like Dick Butkus or somebody like that, and he would throw the ball down the field, and one player from each team would run down and try and recover.
Yeah, remember that? Yeah. I mean, Vince McMahon, leave it to him.
Yeah, and they stopped it because guys were getting hurt on this.
yeah, but listen, that's the nature of tackle football.
Yeah.
I just want them to keep playing. Keep playing. Why stop playing football? You're now out of time.
Right.
So there's no more time in the game. Whoever has the highest score wins. Keep playing football.
Yeah, I agree. I just as one who appreciates defense, and we've had, you know, it's not like during the regular season where we have these same rules. We now have with the 10-minute overtime where they've shortened it from 15. Seems like we've had more ties than ever in the last few years, right?
Yeah, but the thing about appreciating defense, and so do I. You and I have talked about it. The Gus Frerotte game is one of my favorite games of all time. 7-7, whatever. I think I said 10-10, and it was 7-7.
7-7, yeah.
Every time I say one score together, someone corrects me with the other one. And I'm like, okay, I just remember it was almost no score. But all the rules have changed to favor the offense because that's what fans, by and large, want to see. And as a result, it really is. It's not just like, well, so play some defense. The defense is at a disadvantage. And therefore, the team who loses the coin toss is at a disadvantage. But my issue is not that so much as the kind of probabilistic – the luck, the dumb luck. You win a coin flip, you win the game. Nope. Keep playing football, and if you don't want to be at a disadvantage, don't be the team that had to come back to tie the game at the end.
Okay. Yeah, I agree. All right, let's finish up with the quarterbacks here. During the season, we heard various things about Tom Brady as, you know, how well he's playing. My God, he can play till 50, and he didn't discount the idea of playing till he's 50. He had 43 touchdowns, threw for 5,300 yards this year. And according to some metrics, he was the number one quarterback in the league, and it's hard to argue with that. And then all of a sudden, Saturday afternoon or Sunday morning, he's going to retire no matter what happens in this game. What's going on here?
Yeah, I wondered at first, is he looking for leverage with the organization for some reason?
Mm-hmm.
Why float that out there? But when my ears really pricked up is when Ninke said it. When Rob Ninkovich said, hey, Brady, win, lose, or, you know, win or lose, could wind up walking away. I thought, oh, wait a minute, Ninko said that? That's not nothing, you know?
Yeah.
And that's when my ears pricked up. I think that the thing I mentioned on Keyshawn, J. Will, and Max just now, a little while ago, is when Brady says, and because Brady's come out and made the comment now, right? He's talked about it.
Oh, yeah.
If Brady, in my humble opinion, just having lived 48 years of life, if Brady would choose to walk away because his wife and kids have sacrificed for him, and now he has to attend to their needs too, and they don't want to see him get hurt and all those kind of things, and that's why he stops playing. In my opinion, that's a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can't, I mean, everyone has to live their own life. But in my opinion, that's a mistake because you're living for other people, even if it's your loved ones. If, on the other hand, Brady is thinking, you know what? I'm not there for my kids' game. And I am, as Key said, falling asleep during the movie when we have family movie night or whatever. And I'm sick and I want to take them to school sometimes. I can't do any of those things. And if because of that, he says, you know what, that's what I want to be doing. I have to give football up to do that. That's different. I think the motivation for him walking away is important. I think given the many very good decisions he's made in his life, I mean, what's Brady great at? Making great decisions quickly.
Yeah.
I think that he wouldn't, my sense is he wouldn't walk away because he owes it to people around him, but rather because actually that's what he wants to be doing. And as long as that's the motivation, then I would say he's right to walk away. Although Mike Tannenbaum there too had an idea. Hey, Tom, you know what he did for Brett Favre. Don't come to the facility until Wednesday. If you're at the facility before Wednesday, 10 a.m., you're getting fined.
So okay.
Like,
yeah.
Have straddle both worlds.
Yeah.
Have the stuff with your family and also have enough time to prepare for football.
Yeah. Well, after 22 years, it's kind of hard to change the way you do business. But that's understandable. You know, remember the Michael Jordan retirement from the Bulls, the second one, where he said, you know, I'm going to have a pot belly and I'm going to drive the kids to school. And before you know it, he was off to play baseball with the White Sox and then came back to the NBA. So these guys, you know, who can still do it, and obviously Brady can with 43 touchdowns and 5,300 yards, they're not so anxious to say, okay, I can still do it, but I'm walking away. They want to make sure the tank is empty.
Yeah. Although here and there, Sandy Koufax, though he had little choice, his arm was
arm. Ball. Yeah, he's had no injury thing. I mean,
Sanders though.
Barry Sanders
still played at a very high level.
There's a few, but John Elway, you know, knew he was going to have problems with his knees for the rest of his life after winning back to back Super Bowls. I think he thought he could win another one and only left because of injury. So
yes, but there too, you have something unique that Brady could do, which is walk away on his own terms. You know, I was joking about it, but I don't know how much. Brady, because of guys like me saying he can't do it at that age, that fueled his drive, a lot of it. He said so in these podcasts and docuseries and everything. And maybe part of it is that there are no more doubters. Like, you know, I really did – I said in 2016 in the summer, give him 18 months. So that would take you to 2018. And even then I said, look, he could win a Super Bowl as a cooked quarterback with experience like Peyton Manning. Mm-hmm. But he won't be Tom Brady anymore. So that takes it to 2019. We're in 2022. He just led the league in everything.
Yeah.
Right? So I thought he was slowing down looking at him in New England. But really it was his environment and the weapons or the lack of weapons, right?
Yeah.
All those things. So maybe now that there is no one left on the planet Earth saying he can't play next year at a very high level, what's the motivation for him to play?
Yeah, good point. Getaway, Aaron Rodgers, where is he playing next year?
Key had a great option for him, Tennessee.
Ooh, yeah, yeah.
You know, AFC needs, Mike T was talking about it today.
Best running back, yeah.
You need one of those monster weapon quarterback guys to compete with Patrick Mahomes and Josh Allen and Justin Herbert and Joe Burrow and Lamar Jackson, right? Like, you don't. Rodgers is a guy like that. And then you have the running backs, you have the offensive line, you have a coach, you have a defense, you have multiple receivers who can, you know, Julio Jones is still good, A.J. Brown's great right now, you know. You seem to have everything you need. It's nice weather place, and you'd be blazing your own trail because it's not like, well, you're following Drew Brees in New Orleans or you know, doing what Tom Brady just did in Tampa if Brady's not there. So I like the idea of Tennessee.
Yeah, and the organization has never won a Super Bowl, and it's not like the storied history of the Packers even before he got there. Interesting. Very good. Yeah. Always great, Max. Thanks so much.
Likewise. Thanks, Andy.
Take care. That's Max Kellerman, and you hear him every morning here on ESPN 630, and you can see him on TV in the afternoon. He mentioned the Brady comments that he had on his podcast yesterday. I'm going to play some of those coming up at 11 o'clock. Also want to take a deeper look into the big announcement tonight from the Hall of Fame. This is going to be a seminal moment for the Hall of Fame, no matter which way it goes. If Bonds and Clemens get in, it's huge. If they don't get in, it's huge because this is their last year on the writer's ballot. And so this is going to be an enormous announcement tonight, and it's going to be live on the MLB Network coming up at 6 o'clock. Tim Kirkjian weighed in on that last night with Scott Van Pelt. I'm going to play some of that. And also Bob Costas, who's in the Hall of Fame. Tim's going to get in this year. He did a very good commentary on Barry Bonds, and I want to play that for you as well in the next hour. But coming up, it was 48 years ago today that our hopes for getting baseball back here, only 2 years after the Senators left, were quashed, and quashed by the McDonald's magnet. I'll get into that backstory as we continue. It's the Andy Pollin Hour, ESPN 630. We're in for Tony today, 11 to 12, so roll until noon, up until Greeny here on ESPN 630. Before we get to what happened with baseball in this town 48 years ago, I thought I'd reminisce a little bit about the same period of time that happened with something with football up the road at Memorial Stadium in Baltimore. This is one of the most famous plays from Mike Curtis's career. Mike Curtis, borderline Hall of Famer, as far as I'm concerned. Played at Richard Montgomery High School in Rockville and had most of his career with the Baltimore Colts, where he was an incredible linebacker and one of the meanest guys ever to play. Played with just incredible intensity. Passed away within the last year and a half. I believe he had some effects of head injuries. He played in an era where they, you know, guy would get knocked out and they'd ask him how many fingers he had, and if he was close enough, they put him back on the field. But this is a game where the ball is sitting in the middle of the field, and Curtis and the Colts are on defense. I don't remember who they were playing, but the other team is in the huddle, and some drunk fan comes running out on the field. And he picks up the football and starts to run with it. Now, normally, you know, that's a security guard situation where they bring out the guards to get that guy off the field, handcuff him, and take him away. Well, Curtis isn't having anything of it. The fan starts to run off with the football, and he comes by and he clotheslines him. He decks him. You can look it up on YouTube if you want. And so that was like, hey, you know, what are you doing, Mike? He goes, stealing our football. So, you know, not that they wouldn't have other footballs, but he was pissed. Like, you know, we're playing a game here, and this drunk fan comes out of the stands. This is something that happened on Sunday that I wasn't aware of, and the reason I'm not aware of, and you probably aren't as well, is that they don't show these things on TV because it encourages imitators. So it happens all the time in baseball. Some drunk guy comes out of the stands, and the guards chase him around the field, and the fans and the stands have a good laugh, but they don't show it on TV because, you know, people at home, hey, that's fun. Let's go out and do that. So this is during the game. And some guy comes running out on the field, Arrowhead Stadium, and he's wearing a Travis Kelce jersey, and he's riling up the fans. And Stephon Diggs, who played at the University of Maryland, one of the fastest players in the NFL, levels him with his shoulder, knocks him on his back. And they were able to come by and get the with the security people, get the guy off the field. Buffalo was down. It's a big part of the game. Buffalo's down 26-21, 2 minutes left. They had possession of the ball when he lit up the fan. So good for Stephon Diggs for doing that. I don't know. I guess the fan conceivably could file a lawsuit, though I guess, you know, there's got to be something on the ticket which says if you run on the field, we can do what we want with you. But, you know, there's another local guy, Stephon Diggs, went to Good Counsel and University of Maryland and doing the good deed, taking care of the fan. I don't know whether he was drunk or not, but the unruly fan who ran on the field on Sunday. All right, so let me give you a little history on baseball in this town. If you don't know, the original Washington Senators left for Minnesota in 1960 to become the Minnesota Twins. They were immediately replaced by the expansion Washington Senators. Baseball added two expansion teams that year. One of them was the Washington Senators, and the other was the California Angels. So one on the West Coast, one on the East Coast. And so there was like a transition, though the team wasn't as good. At least we didn't lose baseball. So baseball stayed here through 1971. And Bob Short was the owner. He charged the highest ticket prices in the league. The riots had taken place in 1968 after Martin Luther King was assassinated, and there was a period where people, frankly, were afraid to go downtown at night, and attendance was not what they wanted it to be. They never drew a million fans. I think the best was like 800,000 when they had a good year in 1969. So they left, and I remember when they left in 71, there was a feeling, well, don't worry, we're going to get a National League team. And the San Diego Padres were not drawing well. They had become an expansion team in 1969, and there was a question whether, you know, they were going to stay or not. And Joseph Danzanski, who was the chairman of Giant Foods, had a deal in place to buy the team. And Topps Baseball Cards even had San Diego Padres players with like a blank hat, and it just said Washington National League on it, and they did a mock-up for a uniform. I mean, there was a real feel that we were going to get baseball in 1974. Problem was that the Padres had this big lease in San Diego that they couldn't get out of. It was a long-term lease, and Danzanski couldn't buy it out. So he kind of bailed on this, and the word got to Ray Kroc, who was the chairman of McDonald's. Now, he was 71 at the time. You know, he could have just sat back and you know, looked at the Big Mac totals at that point for the rest of his life and would have been fine. But he's somehow got on his yacht newspapers. This is before the internet, but somehow some newspapers were delivered, and he's flipping through it, and he sees this story about Danzanski bailing out on bringing the Padres to Washington. So he gets as much information as he can. I guess he's got some kind of ship-to-shore communication, and he says to his wife, "I think I want to buy the San Diego Padres." And his wife says, "Well, why would you want to buy a monastery?" So he explained to her, no, it's a baseball team. But he had interest in baseball before. He had tried to buy the hometown Chicago Cubs several years before, but that didn't happen. So he calls Padres owner C. Arnholt Smith from the yacht, shipped to shore. They set up lunch several days later. Kroc then heads to shore, catches a plane to San Diego. Shortly after sitting down across the table from Smith, Kroc makes his pitch. "How much?" Smith, $12 million, Kroc, deal. Now you got to remember, this is 1974. The Yankees, the year before, had been sold to George Steinbrenner for less than $10 million. So, you know, That was kind of market price there. And years later, Smith said Kroc's answer still would have been deal, even as Smith had asked for double the selling price. Sale was announced on this day in 1974, January 25th, less than a month after Dan Zansky backed out to bring the team here. Los Angeles, a group headed by Hollywood Park owner Marjorie Everett, had also been rejected as a potential buyer by Major League Baseball to buy the team. And Kroc said, no, we're going to keep the team here. And they did. And he died, sadly, January 14th, 1984, just before the season the Padres won their first National League pennant by defeating the Cubs in the National League Championship Series. And the rest of the story is, because Kroc bought the San Diego Padres, for the next 30 years, we sat here wishing and hoping for Major League Baseball. And there were lots of chances that it was going to happen. I remember fans used to carry around banners at RFK Stadium during Redskin games that said baseball in 87. There was the expansion in 1993. We didn't get a team. Steve Buckhantz broke a story that Houston was going to move here, that there was a deal in place to move the Astros here, and the city of Houston came up with money at the last minute to keep them there. So there's that. And it was 48 years ago today that we got the wah, wah, wah. Padres are staying where they are, and we'll have to wait another. We didn't know that at the time. We'd have to wait another 30 years for baseball. One other quick story here, and this may be of interest to you if you have a spam email folder in your I never really checked that on my computer, but a woman from Michigan happened to be checking through her spam folder because she was looking for another email, and she saw an email from the lottery saying that she won a prize. So she looks in there, and sure enough, she won $3 million. $3 million. Now, this had happened on New Year's Eve. It was a couple of weeks later before she finally opened the email. She hadn't bothered to check her numbers online to see if she had won. And so she says she couldn't believe what she was reading, logged onto my lottery account to confirm the message. It was still shocking to me. I really won $3 million. Not only that, the lottery had advertised a $1 million prize, but she had opted to pay an extra dollar for her ticket to earn the Mega Plier upgrade, which promised to triple her winnings. So instead of $1 million, she won $3 million. And, you know, you would see, unless you played the lottery, I guess if you didn't play the lottery, it would be spam. But, you know, there's got to be something in your mind. Go, ooh, this, you know, because we do this at work. We have to go through all these training sessions to not open these phishing emails that could infect your computer and all that. So there may have been hesitancy to open an email that says you won the lottery. Oh, yeah, sure. But she had actually played the lottery. So I don't play it. So if I got one of those, I wouldn't have looked at it. But very interesting that she was looking for some other email in her spam folder. And had she not done that, it might still be sitting there. I mean, I don't know how long it goes, but eventually I guess it gets flushed out of the system there. So even if she went back like 6 months from now, it might not be there. Wow, what a lucky break. All right, coming up, we'll get into more on the Hall of Fame, the debate about Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens, and also Evan McPherson, the kicker with ice water in his veins, who made the big kick Saturday night, was with Dan Patrick. We'll play some of that conversation as we continue. Tony Kornheiser Show next, ESPN 630.
The countdown is on for the 2024 NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light, live from Detroit, and you can attend in person for free.
Welcome to the NFL Draft.
See the next NFL stars and experience the ultimate NFL fan festival, featuring live concerts, interactive games, player autographs, and more. The NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light, April 25th through 27th. Visit NFL.com/draftaccess to register for free entry today.